Hello and welcome to Words and Pictures, the comics and animation show. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm joined today live in the studio by three rising stars in the Portland comics scene. First, I'd like to welcome the collaborative duo, in fact, the husband and wife duo of Michael Oeming and Taki Soma. Michael and Taki, thanks for coming in today.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
And along with Michael and Taki, we are honored with a return visit from film director, young adult novelist, and comics writer David Walker.
That's too many titles. too much.
Well, welcome back to Words and Pictures, David.
Thanks. Good to be back.
So I want to give a little bit of background just to let everybody, you guys have collaborated on projects together. Michael Oeming, you started out kind of working with Brian Michael Bendis. He's a well-known local artist here, or actually writer here in town. And you worked on a couple of titles that, this is interesting. This is sort of crime noir. This was this was the first genre that you guys did together. You did a couple titles, The United States of Murder Incorporated, which was a little bit more on the realistic side, and Powers, which sort of took that on a more sort of superhero-y side. So yeah, tell me about those two titles there.
Yep, Powers we've been doing for a good Lord, like 15 years now. I think next year will be officially 15. I think the first issue came out in 2000, maybe at the very, very end of 99.
No, it was 2000. I remember it when it came out. Yeah.
All right. Well, that'll make my math a lot easier.
I could be lying. I might have been 99.
But yeah, so we've been doing Powers for 15 years. And when I first started working with Brian, I had actually been around for quite a while at that point. But I wanted to do some creator-owned books with him. I met him and David Mack at a comic book convention together, and I immediately knew that I wanted to work with these cats, and especially with the crime noir stuff because of where my style was going. And when Brian first proposed Powers to me and it had superheroes in it, I was like, But then he explained, no, this is a crime book. This is a noir book. This is
police procedural. You like that style?
Exactly. We were both really into Homicide, that series at the time, which was kind of, you know, the next step after Hill Street Blues, and it was just gritty, realistic stuff. So we wanted to basically do that sort of thing, and it just happened to have some dead superheroes in it. And we've been doing that for about 15 years, and then United States of Murder Incorporated was an idea that we came up with together at like a Halloween party at Randy Bowen's. I was like, what if the mafia never lost the war with the FBI during the 60s and 70s? What would the world be like and stuff? And he thought I was actually proposing this series. I was just asking this theoretical question about crime.
Just speculating, yeah.
So he likes to think that I came up with the idea, and I like to think that the truth is I didn't. I was just asking a question, and his brilliant mind was like, no, this isn't a question. This is a concept.
This is a story.
Exactly. And then we sucker Taki into coloring it.
This actually answers the question, where do good ideas come from? They come from Halloween parties.
Well, the truth is, I think good ideas come from paying attention to ideas. Kind of like the way a criminal pays attention to opportunity, or a police officer pays attention
to the clues.
And I think writers pay attention to what if.
You sit around and you can tell when you get a group of writers in a room together, like somebody will say something and it could just be a clever quote or an idea, and like everybody sort of like
have
perks
their
up and they're like
taking notes.
Let me write this down.
Phones immediately. Yeah, so note to self.
So you and Taki met actually as kind of a long distance romance, and then you've sort of gone in a different direction since then. You've had these titles, Rapture, and now the one that's coming out later this month, Synergy. And they've got more of that kind of fantasy magic element that's you're mashing up sort of monster fiction, things like that, in your new title. Well, let's start with Rapture. Rapture, it's fun. You're kind of playing on both sides of the word. You're playing on that idea of apocalypse, of the post, destructive landscape. And you're also playing with the love story, the totally caught up in the love story side of the word Rapture.
Yeah, it developed out of our long-distance relationship.
And our story specifically came out of the long drive that we had moving me from Minnesota to New Jersey to be with him. And I think it was like a 3-day trip. So we talked a lot about different stories that we would have and we could have, and how to develop it more. And Rapture like became an entire story throughout the trip. And we thought, well, that's the one we should go for first.
Yeah, and it was wrapped around the idea of like how relationships, like a good relationship, feel when it ends, feels like the end of the world. And we were at the beginning of ours, and we knew that, you know, we were taking a chance. I mean, it wasn't any relationship that you're taking is a chance, but, you know, I had just come out of a long marriage and I had a kid. She was moving from one state to another, you know, in the same town. So, I mean, if that didn't work out, and there we are in the same town with my stepson, my ex-wife, she knows nobody else, you know, I mean, it would have been like the end of the world.
So that sense of desperation is right there in the story. You've got these two separated lovers and this blasted landscape between them.
Yeah. And it begins in an airport because all of our hellos and goodbyes were at airports.
Yep.
So now the new title coming out is Synergy. I've got a copy of it in my hands, even though it's not officially on the shelves. And this is some, oh my gosh, the coloring in this is just eye-popping.
That's Taki. I think the style that she developed for United States of Murder Incorporated came out of not knowing what to do. We threw her into the deep end, and I'll let her explain
it's
more.
It's true. I think when they were working on Murder Incorporated, Mike was going to initially just color it. He knows, you know, the basic ways of coloring. So, but after a while, he's like, I don't have time to color. This is ridiculous. I'm like, well, let me take a gab at it. And then I got the job and I'm like, wow, I don't know what I'm doing at all. At all. This is really scary. So, we called up Dave Stewart, who is a colorist for Hellboy, and he's local.
Yeah.
So I'm like, could you please come over and show me the basics of how to color? And that's where it kind of came from. And the coloring choices comes from this Chinese film director.
Wong Kar-wai.
Thank you, because I never remember his name. And we kind of, me, Brian, and Mike all kind of sat down and kind of studied his cinematography and his choices of color and lighting. And Brian's like, this is what I want. I'm like, okay, sure. I'll just put it on comic pages and I'll just plaster it on there. And
you were the gaffer,
yes.
Basically.
Yeah.
So Synergy, the story. Jess is the girl at the center of the story, and she becomes a seer after losing her virginity. She can see the monsters behind the faces of seemingly normal people.
Mm-hmm.
And the first monster, the very first monster she recognizes is her boyfriend, Leaf.
Yes. And I think this happens after you have sex. You suddenly see what kind of monsters people really are.
Yeah.
And
you know, hearing somebody else talk about it from like the outsider point of view, it's like, wow, you guys, what are you working on? What are these issues? Like, oh, yeah.
A bunch of twisted
comics is therapy, yes.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Actually, what I first thought of was the John Carpenter movie, They Live.
Oh,
where,
yeah.
Where the glasses, people
oh,
find
God,
the glasses in the alley.
Oh, really? You didn't think of that? Because I did.
Wow.
I'm like, when I was looking at it, I was like, oh, this is kind of like
They
Live.
Subconsciously ripped it off. Do we have any really long fight scenes?
Yeah. Mind blown.
No, so seriously, you so Taki, you've put a lot of, I mean, you're doing the art, but you also kind of had a lot of you put a lot of input into the characters. Jess's dad was kind of, well, you modeled Jess's dad on the comedian and actor Louis C.K. And I love Louis C.K. as a dad, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
I've got I
he's
love
the best
that,
dad ever.
I love that YouTube. I think it's him on Conan talking about why his girls can't have cell phones. Because, you know, that turns people into mean people. They're abstracted from the rest of humanity. But yeah, so talk about some of the characters in Synergy.
Well, the dad, Jesse, I think, you know, just he's just visually based on Louis C.K. But really, the dad is just a combination of different dads that I've known in my life. You know, they're tough. They love their daughter. They want to protect them, but they need to make their daughter strong. And that's the father that I kind of invented for Jess.
And he's got his work cut out for him because she sees stuff that he can't.
Actually, he is a seer himself.
Oh, okay. I didn't get far into the book. I'm sorry.
So him and his daughter are sharing this seer experience, and the mother is left out.
Okay, it's the mom. And there's also a talking dog. Named Fry. Yes. He looks very
French bulldog. Yes, okay. Is a dog.
Yeah, he's kind of he looks
like a gargoyle is what I'm thinking, sort of like a stone gargoyle.
Yeah. Well, we decided we needed like the sort of Slimer like character, like from Ghostbusters, like a bad guy who's on our side kind of thing. And he was just fun. It was a fun visual to have a talking dog. Plus the original sort of influence on this story was a film that's completely different, Bill Paxton's film
Frailty,
in which it was a family of
That's a family of serial killers or something.
Yeah, but they're getting religious visions based on and it's so good, and it's so well done. But obviously, you know, I just didn't want to do just my version of that, but that was the sort of original impetus of it. And you know, the monster hunting genre is like a subgenre within a genre, you know. There's
I've heard comparisons to, you know, the X-Files and to Buffy, of course,
and Grimm, Supernatural, half a dozen other stuff, you know. So we just needed to find specific rules for our own thing. Most of this is really just metaphor for life, you know, the way the dynamics changes between a mother and a daughter, and a mother and a father, how one sibling can be closer to another, and then as they grow older and things change in their lives, that dynamic changes. I'm sure plenty of people remember how close they were with their mother when they were young, especially girls, and then when they get older, they're finding themselves in a conflicting position with their mother and closer to their father.
Or vice versa,
yeah. And that's not what this is specifically about, but I like finding those metaphors for life because it makes the characters that much more easy, and people enjoy it and not really understand why they're liking that relationship between, you know, how the mother and father is going.
So it's not going to be like the next issue is not going to be the death of Jess, like on the cover and like all this crazy stuff. It's going to be like you're taking it on a long thread through the psychology of the characters, the interactions of the characters. You know, you're definitely putting some psychological depth behind everybody.
Yeah,
here.
But that's all that stuff should be in the background, the subtext. Yeah. You know, a good story is never about what it's about.
Right. So yeah, so Synergy is essentially about family.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a huge, I get, you know,
and
what
David
I'm
is lettering. He's heavily involved in the story. And
there's this coming of age aspect of it too. That moment, like in your adolescence, where it's like you've got your plans for yourself. Your parents might have plans for you, but then the universe has its own separate plans.
Exactly.
And so you see this character like really going through all of this. And then the interesting part of the story for me is that every issue there's a backup story which tells another point of view of the story, which is the point of view of the monsters, the boyfriend. And so that, like, to me, when I first got those pages to letter, I was like, oh, wow, this book's taken on a completely different twist, because to have a story that from the monster's point of view or the villain's point of view suddenly adds this whole other depth to any story, which is like really what like is selling me personally, like as a reader, like if I wasn't just working on it as a reader, that's what's selling me on it.
Yeah. And that's really something Taki really brought to the table. Like we were doing these backup stories, and we knew generally what we wanted to do, but Taki was like, well, what if they're all from the point of view of the bad guy? Because we were talking about how when you write a story and you have an antagonist, you have to write their arc, whether it's in the story or not, because you need to know what the villain's story is, because he's in his own movie and it's from his point of view. And then Taki was like, well, let's take it to the next level.
Which I think is pretty brilliant. So my hat, if I had a hat on, I'd take it off to you right now.
Yeah, obviously there's curveballs that happen in real life. So but you're bringing those out of the narratives that you've already created. So it's not like throwing like a surprise into the mix all of a sudden. It's like, hey, where did that come? Not an unmotivated sort of curveball.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we sit around and talk about this sort of stuff a lot because we're super nerdy and geeky and we I think we've sort of hit this point in our pop culture where like the dastardly villain who wants to take over the world or destroy the world, like, isn't quite enough anymore. It's like, we want to know a little bit more about him. That, you know, that parody of in the Austin Power movies with Dr. Evil, where it's just like, he just wants the money, you know,
or blow like up the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And then,
like,
and then what?
Yeah, yeah. Like in the James Bond movies, it's like, okay, so let me get this straight. Your plan is to destroy the world, and then you're going to live on the moon. Like, what is that? That's the dumbest thing ever. And right. So
who's going to bring you tea?
Yeah,
if you destroy the world.
Exactly. And so I just, you know, to me, like, again, like, for me, when I'm writing, like, I have to look at my villain before I have to look at my hero. I can't do it anymore. I can't write just a hero. And then there comes that moment where you're like, well, what do you do with all this really cool story? You know, it's like, how do I work this in? Because does someone want to read a book about the villain? And sometimes they do. There's some good stuff out there.
Well, so, I mean, there's villains that are beautiful for the mining, or, you know, I mean, folks who are completely sort of consumed by their demons of acquisition out there, who are and it's really funny to look at the real life people who are sort of leaving a scorched earth behind them and looking at their motivations, and sometimes they don't seem to have much of you want to go back to Lex Luthor, because at least he was motivated, at least he had a sense of what he wanted to do.
Well, I think what's worse is the fact that these people, like, in our real world, who are doing these things, they are motivated, they do have a point of view. The problem is we don't understand it, and it could be so offensive or scary to us that we have a block in our heads that we won't allow ourselves to see that point of view. Like, if you're a Nazi and you think that your blood is tainted by inferior human beings, we can't put ourselves in that position. You know, I can't think that way. But the fact is, they did think that way. They weren't, you know, the TV
they didn't sit
monsters.
Around. They didn't sit around and think, we're so evil.
No, they were like, a religious cult.
Yeah,
well, is what they were.
Pretty sure Hitler did, but everybody else. Yeah.
And what's really scary is you look at the Nazis and like, they had, you know, skull and crossbones in your heads. Like, how could you not know that you were not the villain? And here we are with, we've got predatory birds dropping bombs on people across the world. Those people we're dropping bombs on, they think we're the Nazis. You know what I mean? Like, so when we say we can't put our heads in other people's positions, well, guess what? It depends on your point of view. And that's the scary part. And that's a really
that's
scary when you can identify with your villains.
That's a cool hero, too, where the hero's kind of like, oh, I mean, like, look at how many people James Bond has killed over the years. I always go back to him.
Sure.
There's a lot of people that got killed along the way,
yeah,
and sure, killing
that's what
guys.
I really appreciate about the newer films, even when if I'm not 100% on board with them,
yeah,
is that they show his psychological damage,
yeah,
you know, the newer films, like, and it makes him way more relatable than the cool guy. I mean, Sean Connery movies are great to watch, but I don't understand that guy.
Yeah. That seems to be something that's in the body politic right now, is, you know, you look on cable and then there's the heroes that flip to villains and vice versa, you know, the Walter Whites from Breaking Bad, the Dexters.
Yeah. Yeah,
that you know, you end up, people are rooting for them even as they themselves are coming into, they're embracing their villainy.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people, when you are in, you know, rooting for a Walter White or a Dexter, is it's metaphorically you're rooting for them. Like, you're not rooting for him to kill people.
Right.
You're rooting for that motivation.
You almost forget. For me, Walter White was a hard one to root for, because, like, I never forgot how bad he was. Whereas, like, Vic Mackey on The Shield, mm-hmm, you would forget how bad he was. And then towards the end, you're like, okay, wait a sec. The first episode of this show, he killed someone in cold blood.
Yeah.
And you're like,
you have to remind yourself of that.
You have to remind yourself of that. Mm-hmm. But we have to remind ourselves of these things with people in our lives all the time, where it's like, maybe there's somebody who did us something wrong 10 years ago, mm-hmm, but, like, you were 15 at the time, you know?
And,
like,
also, now you're can adults, drive yeah. yourself nuts thinking, I drive my nuts thinking about this all the time, is that people who we see as bad people, they're there because of the path that their life has taken them on. And of course, there's a lot of choice that goes with that. But there's also just, you know, right out front of in your lobby, there's the cards for art that was drawn by death row
inmates.
Mm-hmm. And party wants to go, like, well, why would I want to support anything that a murderer did? First of all, do we even know that the murderers, are they guilty?
Yeah.
Secondly, what brought them to their lives to get them to that position, right? And who am I to judge that?
Yeah,
and that's interesting story stuff.
It's huge to me. Like, yeah, what is the socio-political backstory behind this person's life? I mean,
you threaten to kill people all the time.
I do.
And
yeah.
If you kill somebody, I'm going to be like, well, you know, it was circumstances that led him there, yeah. And I still love David, the murderer.
Think that what Thank we're you. Learning here is that the line between good and evil are very blurry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, SW Conser. It's a good good place to mid-heads on. I'm live in the studio today with three groundbreaking talents in the Portland comics scene, David Walker, Michael Oeming, and Taki Soma. And yeah, I want to give David an opening to talk about Shaft. But first, I do want to mention Michael and Taki. The PlayStation Network. This is like sort of multi-platform thing, not just comic books, but you're going out on the PlayStation Network with... Now, tell me how you're adapting your work for that.
We've had our first film deal with Sony, not Sony PlayStation, but Sony the company, since like 2000. So they've been along with us for every incarnation for the sell and the pitch. The last place where it just didn't work out, Sony was just getting ready to launch their own new streaming content, like Hulu and Netflix and all these other companies are doing. It happened to be the right place at the right time. And what's great is that now everything is in one giant studio. So there's no sort of cross-checking between Sony and somebody else or Sony and somebody. It's Sony within a Sony house. So everything is under one spot. It's a very unique situation that we find ourselves in. Brian Bendis and I are highly involved in the show. I've done a ton of art.
And this is Powers?
Yes, for the Powers TV show. And it's going to be out on Sony PlayStation. And the first episode is going to be free everywhere. I believe they're even putting it on YouTube. I mean, it's just going to be everywhere free.
Yeah, Mike and Brian are both considered executive producers of the show.
Yeah. So we're heavily involved. It's a very unique situation. And then we'll see where it goes from there. It'll be interesting to see if the video game... audience embraces this thing. If outsider people want to come in, we love hearing that people are getting PlayStation 4s or use PlayStation 3s for this.
My mom is like, she's like, I got to get a PlayStation 4.
Aww.
And she is like, she saw that trailer and I was like, don't worry, I'll get you a PlayStation 4.
Yeah. And Aww. Some people will they're upset because, what if I don't have PlayStation? But the answer is, well, what if you don't have HBO? What if you don't have this or that? These are choices we have to make in our entertainment.
That's a good point.
Well, this is such a great time for comic book film crossovers and, multi-platform stuff like web series and all. And on that note, with that segue, I want to talk with Dave Walker about the new title that's coming out in just a few weeks. And that is, and you're going to premiere this at the Hollywood Theater. This is the Shaft comic book from Dynamite Entertainment.
Yeah, we're doing a sort of release signing, ego-stroking party for myself where we're going to show Shaft's big score, which was the 1972 sequel to the movie Shaft. And then I'll answer some questions. And I think Mike is going to be there because he did one of the variant covers.
That's right.
I believe Matt Haley he's going to be there, and I believe Ulysses, I can't remember Ulysses' last name, but it's Dynamite. Dynamite's famous for doing 22-page comics with 44 variant covers. So
in this case, there's a half a dozen. Dennis Cowan and Bill Sienkiewicz, big names, are on one of them.
Who are the other cover artists?
Let's see. Well, there's you. There's Matt Haley. There's Ulysses, whose name is escaping me.
Grant.
Ulysses Grant, former president of the United States. He came back from the dead to draw. There's Sanford Green.
Sanford.
And Francisco Francovilla.
Yes.
And with you, Matt, Dennis, and Sanford, we're all four artists that I'd either approached personally or went to Dynamite and said, go get these guys. Actually, no, I did the combination of the four. One of the things I really wanted to try to do was, if I couldn't have that much input into who drew the actual book, I wanted input into who was doing the covers. I wanted to work with artists whose work I really loved and who I felt would like just bring an energy to the story. And so this first round of covers has blown my mind. I still haven't even seen all the covers for issue 2 yet, but that's sort of how the train of communication works at
Well, let's also give a shout out to the artist on the inside because David was good enough to send me an advance digital copy. And Bilquis Evely, is that right?
I believe that's how she says her name. She's Brazilian, and so she'll be a star because no one knows how to pronounce her name. And that's one of the big things in comics. Like, if you don't know how to pronounce a first or last name, you're good. It's like Bill Sienkiewicz. Is it Omin? Umin? Amin? You know, it's like, yeah.
So. Now, she just reminds me of my favorite period of time in sort of mainstream comics, which was the mid to late 70s.
Yeah.
That great sort of black and white, heavily modeled kind of
very Jerry Dono and Neal Adams.
And it's almost a shame that the book's going to be in color because her black and white work is so amazing. But it's dynamite. They might release a black and white variant edition at some point.
I'll
be happy.
It's so good. When I saw, I don't want to steal your thunder with this at all, but when you showed me the art for this book, rarely does my jaw drop. And, you know, and usually I'm like, oh wow, this art is really good.
I was really angry.
Yeah, this was like who is this person?
Amazing. Because she's like 23.
Yeah
that's the Taki's like, too. She better not be beautiful and young.
Yeah.
I think I've seen a picture of her. I'm not sure, and it's like, yeah, she's like way more attractive than she deserves to be as well.
That is so unfair.
But she's amazing, and she's bringing her A game, which is helping me up my game, and we communicate just a little bit via email. And I sent her an email as I was finishing up the final issue, and I said, well, this is the final issue that we know for sure we're doing together. I said, is there anything you want to draw? Because if there is, I will incorporate it into the script, because that's sort of how I feel the collaborative process should be.
Oh yeah. And you're sort of a mentoring figure. I mean, that's great. She's 23. My God, it's kind of like when Jimi Hendrix went to London, you know, and Eric Clapton went to see him and immediately went home and practiced his guitar because, you know, this young kid is blowing it away.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Yeah, the you know, older people like us need the blood of young creative people. Like, I've definitely noticed that's true.
This is where vampire stories come from, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a metaphor for that. But I've definitely noticed that as I've gotten older.
Yeah, I've threatened the artist I just met. I was like, I'm going to chop off your arm and I'm going to eat it. Because I think that's how you get powers.
You could absorb talent that way.
Smoke your spine.
Yeah.
So David, anyway, so it's great that the art kind of harkens back to that 70s look, because you're harkening back. You're not updating Shaft at all for the 21st century. This is you're going back actually, and I didn't know this at first until I read your site, badassmofo.com. Mm-hmm. You are going back to the Ernest Tidyman books, which predated the movies. And you've actually talked with Ernest's widow, Chris Clark Tidyman.
Yep.
And
her and I are she's really helped guide this process and just in a lot of sort of inspirational little stories. And yeah, to me, it was like, I enjoy the movies, but the books are where that character first came from, that incarnation. And that's what I went to. And this first story arc deals with Shaft before anyone ever got to know him, before the first book ever came out, before the first movie ever came out. So it's kind of like an origin story,
right?
But not really an origin story, because he's not bitten by like a radioactive cockroach or anything like that.
Well, he's definitely doing a little bit of exposition about his background. I mean, there's this great little sequence on about half a dozen pages in where he's saying, when I was 17, the judge gave me a choice, go to prison or join the military. I chose to not go to prison.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he does this whole thing about choices going up the line. That's really fascinating. It's introducing these other characters along the way.
And that's what I've tried to keep that thread going through all six issues of this first story arc. I just finished up the final issue. And it's you learn a lot about the character, both through what he's explaining to you, which oftentimes is in contrast to what he's actually doing. And, you know, it's him. There's a sequence in the second issue where he kills some people, and he's sort of marveling at how easy it was to go back to killing, because he's a vet. He was in the war. He killed a bunch of people, and how he had hoped it would be more difficult, and it wasn't. And so that kind of gives you this idea of like, this is where this guy is going. And what we're going back to the conversation earlier, like Shaft walks that line between good and bad. And like the good people hate him and the bad people hate him, because to the good people, he's a bad guy. And to the bad guys, he's one of the good guys. And that's what makes him endlessly fascinating to me. And he's just a very flawed character. And perhaps, you know, Tidyman put the foundation there, and I'm building on it. And I guess I can talk about this. I don't really care. I'm also writing the first Shaft novel in 40 years.
Wow.
And that's really getting into like what he's capable of. I just wrote a sequence today where he's stitching together a wound from where he's been shot. And it's talking about, you know, he remembered the first time when he actually had to push his intestines back into his body and sew himself up.
Wow.
So this
Shades
is nothing.
Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah,
wow.
You know.
Yeah. Wow. Well, wow. So the comic book is coming out at the
December
Hollywood
3rd.
Theater.
It'll be 3rd. Out in stores December 3rd, and then on the 16th is when we're having the party.
The 16th at the Hollywood Theater.
And it's going to be a party,
Shastic
man.
Score. Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. Our guests today have been comics artists and writers David Walker, Michael Oeming, and Taki Soma. So, David, Badass Mofo is the website for information about your work.
Sure.
Yeah,
why not?
Okay. Your films and your young adult novels and things like that. David and Taki, how can people find out more about the new title Synergy as well as your other projects?
I have a website, takisoma.com, but I have not updated it in years. So I would say go to Twitter, find me, Takisoma, or Facebook.
T-A-K-I-S-O-M-A.
You got it.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining us in the studio today.
Thank you.
And thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. I'm your host, SW Conser. You can find an archived version of this show later today at KBOO.FM/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter @wordsandpicture. Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown Portland radio station.
Damn right.
And now for the KBOO News at Noon for Thursday, November 13th, 2014. The extremely close vote for Oregon's Measure 92 on labeling GMOs may not be fully decided. Oregon election officials say that around 13,000 voters whose ballots had signature problems have one more week to resolve the issue. Oregon voters are required to sign the envelope containing their ballot, not the ballot itself. If they fail to sign the envelope, the ballot is rejected. Voters have until next Wednesday, November 19th, to ensure their vote is counted. Concerned voters can go to the website OregonVotes.gov to look up their information to ensure that their vote has been counted. Measure 92 has been provisionally defeated, but the no votes are just over 9,000 more than the yes votes, so the 13,000 rejected ballots may yet make a difference in the race. A federal judge has fast-tracked Detroit's bankruptcy plan. Judge Stephen Rhodes has not set an official date for Detroit to leave bankruptcy, but did waive a 14-day stay on their adjustment plan. The city of Detroit is currently $20 billion in debt. It plans to exchange $7 billion in debt for a $1.7 billion